A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You're on the tarmac. The seatbelt sign is off, but the door isn't open. The captain comes on and says there's going to be a short delay. Something about a minor technical inspection. You look out the window and there it is. The engine cowling wide open. A person in a high VV vest pointing a flashlight into the guts of a jet engine. And you think, is this routine or should I be nervous?
That scene is one of the most universally shared passenger experiences in commercial aviation, and also one of the least understood. Almost everyone who flies has seen it. Almost nobody knows what's actually happening inside that cone of flashlight beam.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been that passenger, staring out the window, watching a technician poke around an exposed engine, and he wanted to know what's really going on. Is it actually just an inspection, or is there maintenance happening? What kind of training do those people have? Can they work on any plane in the fleet, or are they locked to one type? And how does someone even get into that job?
These are exactly the right questions, because the gap between what we see as passengers and what's actually happening on the tarmac is enormous. And the short version is, that person with the flashlight is the last line of defense in a safety system that's been built up over decades. What looks casual is anything but.
Let's start with the two worlds of aircraft maintenance, because that distinction is the key to understanding the whole scene.
There are really two completely different universes of aircraft maintenance, and they barely resemble each other. The one most people hear about is heavy maintenance, sometimes called base maintenance. That's the hangar work. The aircraft is taken out of service for days or weeks, stripped down, inspected to the last rivet. Those are the C-checks and D-checks, the full overhauls. It's scheduled years in advance, every single bolt turn is documented, and the aircraft doesn't carry a single passenger while it's happening.
Right. The stuff of documentaries. Time-lapse footage of a 747 getting its skin peeled off.
And then there's the other universe, which is what Daniel's actually asking about. This is everything that happens on the tarmac, between flights, often with passengers already on board or about to board. It covers daily checks, pre-flight walkarounds, and crucially, the troubleshooting of anything unexpected that pops up between those big scheduled hangar visits.
The hangar is the planned surgery. The tarmac is the emergency room.
That's actually a useful way to think about it. And here's what makes line maintenance genuinely different from heavy maintenance. It's the time pressure. A C-check might have a 2-week window. A line maintenance decision sometimes has to be made in 15 minutes. Because the aircraft has a departure slot and 200 people are waiting. The technician has to determine whether something is safe to defer, whether it needs immediate attention, or whether the aircraft shouldn't fly at all. That's a staggering amount of responsibility.
It sounds reassuringly trivial, but the person making that call is exercising real judgment.
Minor in this context doesn't mean unimportant. It means the issue isn't expected to be catastrophic, but it still needs to be verified. By a qualified person with a flashlight, following a documented procedure. The flashlight isn't casual. It's the tool for what's called a general visual inspection, and every zone they check is defined in the aircraft maintenance manual.
When Daniel sees that engine cowling open and someone peering inside, he's watching the front line of aviation safety, the last checkpoint before the aircraft commits to flight. It's not the hangar's scheduled deep dive. It's the safety net that catches things between those dives.
That's the thing most passengers don't realize. The system is designed with the assumption that things will go wrong between scheduled checks. A sensor will throw a fault code. A pilot's walk-around will spot a fluid drip. A bird strike will leave residue that needs investigating. Line maintenance exists precisely because the unexpected is expected. Let's get specific about what that technician is actually doing with that flashlight, because it's a lot more than just looking. The procedure is called a general visual inspection, a GVI, and it's a fully documented, regulated process. Every single zone of that engine bay is mapped in the aircraft maintenance manual. The technician isn't wandering a beam around out of curiosity. They're working through a checklist, zone by zone, and the angle of the flashlight matters because you're looking for things that only catch light at certain orientations.
It's not shine a light and see what's weird. It's zone 3, check for oil streaking at the accessory gearbox seam, then zone 4, look for discoloration on the bleed air ducting.
And the list of what they're hunting is specific. Oil leaks, engine oil, or hydraulic fluid are probably number 1. Then foreign object damage, what the industry calls FOD, that could be a tool left behind, a piece of runway debris that got kicked up, or loose hardware that's backed out from vibration. They're checking for cracks in visible structural components, signs of overheating. You'll see discolored metal or blistered paint, and anything that looks like it shifted or chafed since the last inspection.
How often do they actually find something?
More than passengers would guess, but almost never anything catastrophic. The most common findings are oil seepage from a seal that's starting to go, tire wear approaching limits, brake wear indicators showing, and, this one surprises people, bird strike residue.
I figured bird strikes were rare. The stuff of that Sully movie and not much else.
They're astonishingly common. The FAA records something like 14,000 bird strikes a year in the U.S. alone. The vast majority leave nothing more than a smear. But here's the thing. A bird strike can cause internal engine damage that leaves zero visible trace on the outside. You get what's called a soft body ingestion. The bird goes through the fan blades and into the core, and the only way to know if there's damage is to look inside.
Which is where the borescope comes in.
That's the tool that turns a brief inspection into a delay. A borescope is a flexible fiber optic camera. Think of a long snake with a lens and a light at the tip. Modern ones produce high-definition video. The engine casing has specific inspection ports built into it, little access holes plugged during normal operation. You remove the plug, insert the borescope, and now you can examine the compressor blades, the turbine blades, the combustion chamber, all without disassembling a single major component.
When the captain says there's a brief technical inspection, and 40 minutes later you're still sitting there, it's probably a borescope job.
On a CFM56-7B engine, that's the workhorse on the Boeing 737 next generation. A full borescope inspection takes 20 to 45 minutes depending on what you're looking for. The technician is navigating through the engine's internal geometry, checking each blade stage for cracks, nicks, or erosion. A single cracked turbine blade that gets missed can fail catastrophically within 10 to 20 more flight cycles. The inspection finds it, the engine gets taken out of service on the ground, and nobody on that aircraft ever knows they were 10 flights from a potential uncontained failure.
That's the part that reframes the whole experience. The delay isn't the problem. The delay is the system catching the problem.
This connects back to why the cowling is open in the first place. The fan cowl doors on a 737NG are a beautiful piece of design. They're hinged at the top, they swing open 90 degrees, and they're held by gas struts. One person can unlatch and open both doors in under 30 seconds. Once they're open, you have immediate access to the entire accessory gearbox, the oil level sight glass, the chip detectors, the integrated drive generator, the hydraulic pump. All the components that most frequently need a quick check are right there, deliberately placed for rapid access.
The engineering anticipates that someone's going to need to get in there fast, between flights, probably at night, probably in the rain.
That's exactly the design philosophy. Line maintenance isn't an afterthought. The engine is built around the assumption that it will be inspected and serviced on the tarmac, under time pressure by a single technician. The most common access points are positioned for that reality.
Which brings me to the language the airline uses. Non-serious technical inspection. That phrase has always sounded to me like they're managing my emotions rather than telling me what's happening.
It's actually a regulatory constraint. Airlines are required to inform passengers of delays and the reason for them, but they are specifically prohibited from speculating about unconfirmed issues. If a fault light came on, or a pilot reported a vibration, or a ground crew spotted a fluid drip, until a certified technician completes the inspection and makes a determination, the airline doesn't officially know what the problem is. Non-serious technical inspection is the standard phrasing for, we have an indication that requires verification before we can legally dispatch this aircraft.
It's not a euphemism to keep me calm. It's liability management baked into the regulatory framework.
And non-serious means what it says. The initial indication doesn't suggest an imminent safety threat. If it did, they'd evacuate the aircraft, not open a cowling and grab a flashlight. The system has gradations, and the fact that they're doing a tarmac inspection rather than ordering an emergency deplaning tells you something real about the severity.
That's actually reassuring in a counterintuitive way. The inspection happening at all is evidence that the worst-case scenario is already off the table. We know what they're doing out there with the flashlight, but Daniel also asked who these people are. How do you become the person trusted to open an engine cowling on a live aircraft with 200 passengers watching?
The baseline credential is the FAA Airframe and Power Plant Certificate, the A&P. That's the entry ticket to touch any U.S. registered aircraft. You get it one of two ways, either through an FAA-approved Part 147 school, which is typically a two-year program, or through military aviation maintenance training. After that, you need 18 to 24 months of supervised practical experience before you can even sit for the exams.
The exams themselves.
Three written tests, general, airframe, and power plant, plus an oral and practical exam with an FAA-designated examiner. The practical isn't a multiple-choice thing. You're handed a real component with a real fault and told to diagnose it. The failure rate on the first attempt runs around 30%.
Just getting the license is a serious filter. But Daniel's question was sharper than that. Once you have the A&P, can you work on any plane?
And this is where most people get it wrong. The A&P is the foundation, but to actually sign off work on a specific aircraft type, a 737, an A320, you need a type rating. It's directly analogous to what pilots need. A specialized training course on that exact aircraft systems followed by an exam.
A technician with a 737 type rating can't just walk over to an Airbus and start turning wrenches.
They cannot sign off work on a type they're not rated for. But within a type rating, there's flexibility. A technician rated on the 737 can work on any variant. The 737-700, the 737-800, the 737-900ER, the MAX, same type rating, covers all of them. Same deal with the A320 family, which covers the A318, A319, A320, and A320.
Which means an airline like Southwest, which flies nothing but 737s, has a fleet where every technician can work on every aircraft.
Southwest technicians are 737 exclusive, and that uniformity is a huge operational advantage. Compare that to United, where a technician might hold type ratings on the 737, the 747, and 777, and multiple Airbus families. That cross-training takes years and costs the airline a fortune, but it gives them flexibility to move technicians between fleet types as needed.
There's an odd little loophole I came across, something the FAA calls differences training.
That's a real thing, and it's one of those regulatory details that sounds alarming until you understand the limits. If a technician is already rated on one type and needs to work on a similar but unfamiliar aircraft, they can take a 2-hour differences training module. But, and this is the crucial restriction, it only applies to line maintenance, not heavy maintenance. You cannot do a full structural overhaul on an airframe you only know from a 2-hour briefing.
Which makes sense. The line maintenance context is narrower. You're troubleshooting known systems, not disassembling primary structure. Still, 2 hours feels thin.
It's thin, and it's controversial in some corners of the industry. But the FAA's logic is that a technician with deep experience on, say, the 757 can adapt to the 767 quickly enough for line-level work because the system's architecture is similar. Both are Boeing designs from the same era, same philosophy, same cockpit commonality. Whether that logic holds up in every case is something the industry continues to debate.
The certification ladder is clear. Part 147 school or military, then A&B, then type rating. But where does someone actually start their career? Nobody's handing a freshly minted A&P. The keys to a line maintenance shift at a major hub.
The first job is almost never line maintenance. Most new technicians start at regional airlines or at MRO facilities. Maintenance, repair, and overhaul organizations. That's where you build the experience base. You're working on aircraft that are out of service, in a hangar, under supervision, with time to learn. The troubleshooting skills that line maintenance demands. Making accurate calls in 15 minutes with the departure deadline. Those come after years of seeing how systems actually fail in the real world.
The data backs that up. The average line maintenance technician at a major carrier has 10 to 15 years of experience before they're trusted with unsupervised tarmac inspections and dispatch authority.
That number doesn't surprise me at all. The dispatch decision is the single highest pressure moment in commercial aviation maintenance. The technician has to determine whether an issue is safe to defer under the minimum equipment list, the MEL, or whether the aircraft needs immediate attention or whether it shouldn't fly at all. And they're making that call at 2 in the morning, in the rain, with the gate agent asking for an update every 10 minutes.
The MEL is worth unpacking because it's the regulatory mechanism that makes the whole system work. What exactly does it allow?
The minimum equipment list is an FAA-approved document specific to each aircraft that says, here are the things that can be inoperative and still allow safe flight, and here are the conditions. A redundant hydraulic pump can be deferred. A coffee maker can be deferred. A thrust reverser on one engine can be deferred, but only with performance penalties and only for a limited number of days. But a primary flight control? The MEL is granular, and only a certified technician with the proper type rating can inspect the issue and formally make the deferral.
The technician isn't just deciding, this looks okay. They're consulting a legally binding document that defines exactly what's permissible and under what constraints.
That document lives inside a larger regulatory framework called the Continuous Airworthiness Maintenance Program, the CAMP. Every Part 121 airline, which is any U.S. carrier flying scheduled passenger service, must have a CAMP, and that CAMP must be approved by the FAA. Line maintenance is a core component of the CAMP. It's not an optional extra, it's a regulatory requirement. The airline has to demonstrate that it has qualified personnel, documented procedures, and adequate staffing to handle unscheduled maintenance at every station it operates from.
Which brings up another of Daniel's questions. Are these technicians airline employees, or are they from some outside company?
It depends on the station. At the airline's hubs and major bases, line maintenance technicians are almost always direct employees of the airline. They wear the airline's uniform, they're on the airline seniority list, they're trained to the airline's specific procedures. But at outstations, smaller airports where the airline only has a few flights a day, it doesn't make economic sense to staff a full line maintenance team, so they contract it out.
To the MROs.
Companies like AAR, HAECO, ST Engineering, these are global maintenance organizations that provide line maintenance services at outstations for multiple airlines. The technician you see opening a cowling in Boise might work for an MRO, not for the airline whose name is painted on the side of the aircraft.
They still need the same certifications.
They still need the A&P, and they still need the type rating for whatever aircraft they're working on. The regulatory requirements don't change just because the employer is a contractor, but the oversight and the training culture can vary. An airline's in-house technicians are immersed in that airline's specific procedures, its maintenance software, its reporting culture. An MRO technician might be servicing three different carriers in a single shift, each with slightly different paperwork requirements and MEL configurations.
That sounds like it introduces variability into a system that otherwise prides itself on standardization.
It does, and it's an acknowledged tension in the industry. The FAA audits both airlines and MROs, and the standards are supposed to be identical. But anyone who's worked both sides will tell you there's a difference in culture and depth of familiarity. An airline technician who's worked on the same fleet type for 15 years has an intuitive feel for how those specific aircraft age and fail. An MRO technician might be competent across multiple types, but less deeply specialized in any one.
That goes back to the experience number you mentioned. 10 to 15 years before you're making unsupervised dispatch calls. The system seems to recognize that certification alone isn't enough. There's a whole layer of judgment that only comes from time.
That judgment is built in brutal conditions. Line maintenance technicians work 12-hour shifts, outdoors, in whatever weather the day brings. A lot of the work happens at night, because that's when aircraft sit on the ground between the last flight, which is the reality most passengers never see. The person who signed off your aircraft at midnight in a snowstorm has probably been doing this for over a decade.
What does all this mean for Daniel, or anyone else, the next time they're sitting on a delayed plane staring out the window? First thing, that technician with the flashlight isn't just looking. They're executing a documented, regulated procedure, zone by zone, from the aircraft maintenance manual. The delay isn't the system failing. The delay is the system working.
you can actually read the scene a little once you know what to look for. If the technician is just shining a light, checking a few specific points, and walking away, that's probably an oil level or a visual confirmation of something the pilot's already flagged. If you see a cable snaking in through a port in the engine casing, a borescope, that's a deeper inspection. It's still almost certainly going to find nothing, but it's going to take 20 minutes.
The borescope is the tell. Flashlight in 30 seconds, you're leaving. Cable and camera, you're settling in.
If you're the person next to you asking what's happening, now you have an answer that's better than, I don't know, probably nothing. You can say, they're doing a general visual inspection. It's a regulated procedure. And the fact that they're doing it on the ground instead of discovering the issue at 35,000 feet is exactly why commercial aviation is as safe as it is.
That's the broader lesson that really lands for me. Aviation maintenance is a system of redundant checks. The design engineers build in inspection ports. The CAM schedules the heavy checks years in advance. The pilots do walkarounds. And then, at the very end of the chain, there's a person with a flashlight on the tarmac, the last line of defense before the aircraft commits to flight. The fact that this layer catches things and causes delays isn't a weakness. It's the entire point.
The safety statistics bear that out. The fatal accident rate for U.S. commercial aviation has been effectively zero for over a decade. That doesn't happen because aircraft never break. It happens because the system is designed to catch the breaks before they matter.
For anyone listening who hears all this and thinks, that sounds like a job I'd want, Daniel asked how people get into it, and the pathway is clear. Part 147 school, or military aviation maintenance, then the A&P certificate, then a type rating on whatever fleet your employer operates. Start at a regional or an MRO, build experience for a few years, and line maintenance is a career track, not a dead end.
The best technicians move into supervisory roles, or they specialize in non-destructive testing, NDT, using ultrasound and eddy current to find cracks no visual inspection could catch. Some go into engineering, helping design the next generation of inspection procedures. The A&P certificate hasn't fundamentally changed in 50 years, but the career it opens into is evolving fast. There's a question that hangs over all of this, and it's the one I keep coming back to. We're entering an era where engines stream real-time health data to the ground via satellite. Temperature, vibration, pressure, every parameter continuously monitored. The computer flags anomalies before a pilot feels anything. So at some point, does the person with the flashlight become redundant?
That's the tension, isn't it? The data says the bearing temperature rose half a degree. Does a visual inspection add anything the sensor didn't already catch?
The honest answer is, sometimes no, but sometimes absolutely yes. A sensor can tell you a vibration signature changed. It cannot tell you that a seal is weeping fluid that hasn't dripped yet, or that a composite panel has a hairline crack that only catches light at a specific angle. The human eye and the flashlight are still finding things the data misses.
The flashlight probably isn't going anywhere, but the job is transforming around it. The next generation of line technicians is going to need to read a tablet full of predictive analytics and then go outside and put hands on the engine. That's a fundamentally different skill blend than what the A&P was designed for 50 years ago.
The A&P itself hasn't changed much in that time. The curriculum still emphasizes pistons and magnetos, technology from the 1940s, alongside modern turbine systems. There's an active debate inside the FAA about whether the certificate needs a structural overhaul to reflect the data-driven reality of modern line maintenance.
Which means the person Daniel watches through the window 10 years from now might be holding a tablet in one hand and a flashlight in the other, correlating a predictive model with what their own eyes are telling them. Same job, different tools, same responsibility.
That brings us to the thing I hope sticks with people. Next time you're delayed on the tarmac, look out that window. The person with the flashlight is the last link in a chain that starts with design engineers and ends with your landing. They're not just checking. They're the reason the system works.
The delay is the proof. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, an expedition in Papua New Guinea documented a ceremonial counting system among the Bukawa people that used 19 distinct body points. Left pinky, left ring finger, left middle finger, all the way up the arm, across the face, and down the other side. To count to 19. That same system was rediscovered in a missionary's unpublished field notes in 2014, and when linguists tested it against modern Bukawa speakers, they found the sequence had been preserved with zero drift for nearly a century.
Zero drift for 100 years, with no written record. That's remarkable.
Makes you wonder what else is sitting in someone's field notes.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, and to Daniel for the question. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.